I am my car. I am my clothes. I am my bank account. I am my house. I obey my thirst. I have it my way. I just do it. I deserve a break today. I double my pleasure, double my fun. I live the high life because I'm worth it. I'm looking out for number one. I wait for nothing. I have a million choices. I get what I want. I do what's best for me. I spend my time where I want to spend it. No one wastes it but me. I have the world at my fingertips. If it doesn't work, I'll throw it out and get a new one. If I'm uncomfortable, I leave. There's another place just down the street. If I'm unhappy, I'm missing something. I find it. I buy it. If I want it, I get it. I accumulate. I collect. I acquire. I take. I use. I devour. I consume. I am not the center of the universe, but I'm the center of mine. I want to know what's in it for me. I want to know what I get out of it. I'm here to find happiness. I live for comfort. I exist to be served. The world exists to serve me. I am the customer. The customer is king. I am king.
Well, that's kind of a convicting video, isn't it? Yeah, thanks a lot, Rob. Play that right in the middle of my Christmas shopping. Thanks. See, and the point of that is not that somehow shopping is bad or inherently evil, so we can all rest at ease over that. There's nothing inherently wrong with shopping. The point of that video, and the point that we might be wanting to make here, is that there's an attitudinal development that occurs in a consumer-driven society like the one that we're present. Attitude that becomes selfishly motivated, especially over time. It's an attitude that begins to develop saying, I want what I want it my way, and I want everything that I demand because I'm a customer, and as customer, I'm king. I'm deserving of these things. We're fed this constant stream of advertising and enticements informing us that happiness comes when we have exactly what we want. And of course, they're informing us what it is that we want. Something that shoots salad out like a gun. That will make us happy. If, as long as we're buying the product, as long as we're getting the service, as long as we're treated like royalty, then somehow we'll find wholeness and happiness from that. Now, of course, that's the thing that keeps our national economy going. What we're talking about there, exactly what I'm describing there is something that this nation is completely dependent on, a constant demand for and consumption of products and services by the masses. And everything that promotes those products and services does so by putting our needs and our desires as a number one priority that has to be met. So when we're informed on a regular basis about what it is that you've had desperately needed, hair out of a spray can or something along those lines, when we're informed about that, our needs, our desires are of number one priority. That's the most important thing. Nothing is more important than getting what I want, of satisfying myself, because that's where happiness and contentment are supposed to be found, in the satisfying of my desires and my needs and my want. So we begin to embrace a certain sense of entitlement over time. Well, of course I deserve these things. That's who I am. I'm a customer. I deserve these kinds of things. I deserve to get it my way because my way is the absolute most important thing on earth, because my way is the only way that's going to produce happiness, is going to produce wholeness for me. Now, the core danger of a consumerist culture like the one that we're in is the resultant self-centric attitude and approach to other non-consumable things, non-consumable aspects of life. We end up approaching things like relationships, like marriage, like consumers do, evaluating these things based on personal benefit and missing the deeper meaning, the deeper strength of those things. This is certainly true for how we end up looking at religion. I would venture to guess that most people come to a church environment, a church community and service like a consumer. We look around to see if this is going to meet my needs, see if it's going to be efficient in meeting my needs, kicking the tires, determining whether or not this is going to provide the right kind of service that I want and take care of me the way that I want to be taken care of. And yet, all through the Gospel of Luke, as we've been studying that, Jesus has been pointing us in a different direction altogether. Jesus' way is definitively countercultural, especially as it touches ours. And it challenges the comfort zones of the present culture that we're living in right now. Jesus is standing at the entrance to a completely different pathway, a very narrow path. And he's inviting us to follow that path with him all the way home. But it's also a path that actually leads us into wonderful discoveries about what it really means to be a human being in this life and how we really do find wholeness and satisfaction in this life that we're living right now. We're going to continue our study in the Gospel of Luke today. So if you've got a Bible or a Bible app that can follow along with me, if you will head over to Luke chapter 22, please. In our story so far, Jesus has settled in to celebrate the Passover with his disciples, and we looked at Jesus' emotional expression of love to his disciples during that meal, how he was longing to do this meal with them because he wasn't going to have the chance to do it like that, to share that with them the same way pretty soon. And we considered the import of that, that God not only loves us, but he actually likes us. He wants to hang with us. And that's an important thing to keep in mind. And during the Passover, Jesus instituted his own table. And that's what we kind of examined last week, the symbols of the bread and cup, which were pointing towards the sacrifice that he was about to make on behalf of everyone by dying on the cross. And then as he said all this, as he got to that, he dropped this bombshell on them as they're there at the table with them, that somebody from their own midst is going to actually betray him to the authorities. One of their own crew is going to do that. So that's the scene. That's what's just happened. They've gone through all these things. He's just shared this news that one of their own midst is actually going to betray them. He's about to be arrested and taken off and go through what it is he's about to go through. And if you're there in chapter 2, we're going to pick up the story. This heavy revelation about what Jesus is about to suffer on our behalf. So this is how the disciples respond. Verse 22, a dispute also arose among them as to which of them was to be regarded as the greatest. And there we have it. Hours before Jesus is going to be arrested, tried, and crucified, his followers are arguing over who's going to be awarded disciple of the month this time around. Now it says a dispute arose, but literally it's a rivalry. It pictures the idea of the struggle that you see when somebody's playing King of the Hill. One wants to be on top and he's fighting with the others to keep them down. Now, this may not have been so bad if this were just kind of something that we come across and we say, wow, okay, well, you know, it's human nature, blah, blah, blah. But this has already come up with the disciples. And if you've been with us in Luke, you know that back in chapter 9, in this same context, Jesus had just told his followers, his disciples, I'm going to actually be going to Jerusalem and I'm going to be dying on your behalf. And this exact same argument came up. They'd started arguing about who was going to be the greatest among them. They thought they were doing it back in chapter 9 out of earshot of Jesus, but he's Jesus. So he knew what was going on. He knew exactly, and he confronted the argument, and he taught them the lesson that greatness comes by service to our fellow man, by serving others. But the theme resurfaces here, which tells me that it didn't really take back then. It didn't really actually get resolved with them. And I can almost imagine how this got started. Jesus tells them, somebody here in this very room is actually going to betray me. And so they're starting to ask, well, who could do this, you know? And more than likely, they're eliminating themselves from possibility in this. Well, you know, well, it wouldn't be me. I'm not going to betray him. I'm his number one disciple. And somebody else says, yeah, whatever, you know, you kind of smell like number two if you get my drift. So, I don't think you're the great. I'm obviously the best disciple. Another disciple goes, look, I could explain to you losers how it is that I'm the best disciple, but I'm just so humble, I can't do that. But in fact, I'm awesome when it comes to humility. And from there, it just escalates into this full-blown argument among them, a fight about who it is that's the coolest one at the table. Now, this could possibly discourage us to read something like that, and we see this human nature coming, around the corner again. But in actuality, this little scene right here, as absurd as it is, should actually give us a lot of hope. It sure does me. It gives me a lot of hope when I read this, because as we stated last week, these are the guys that Jesus was really longing to hang out with and have this meal with. He likes these guys who are fighting over who's the coolest among them. That gives me a lot of hope. When I look at that and I realize how he responds and where his heart and head is in this whole thing, man, I think it's awesome. Because this scene is ludicrous. I mean, it really is. I mean, how does this make them look when we read a story like this? How, I mean, what comes to mind when you see this kind of behavior? How are they behaving? What do you think of immediately?
Children.
Like children? Selfishly, I heard. What else did I hear? Like us. Exactly. Exactly. Like us. But certainly there's a certain level of selfishness in here. There's this pride that's being represented in it. Do they look really smart by doing this sort of thing in the face of everything that Jesus has just told them? No. So this sort of provides us our first point this morning, and that is selfish pride makes us stupid. And actually, that's all we need to say about that part. We can move on. Verse 28, verse 25. And he said to them, "The kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and those in authority over them are called benefactors. But not so with you. Rather, let the greatest among you become as the youngest, and the leader as one who serves." So Jesus stops the argument by giving them a quick civics lesson, and he sets up this contrast between the prevailing philosophy of leadership in this broken world, and he identifies it with the Gentile world, but what he's basically saying in that is that leadership, you know, the governments that are not submitted to the control of God, that's the to God's rule, that's the concept there. So he's contrasting that with the values of God's idea of leadership, and he points to the present system that they're in. Those who are in leadership positions take full advantage of that position, and they throw their weight around. They try to, you know, they get corrupted by that authority. They elevate themselves and use titles like benefactor. So what he means there is that even though they're providing something, they're doing so with this title, which automatically says that they're providing it from a place of superiority to everybody else. Power is something that just goes to people's heads. We don't have to even try to belabor that point. That's just obvious. We've already seen so many examples in history over that. And that's what causes people to become abusive and conceited, this lust for and this desire for power. And Jesus emphatically states here, not so with you, not so with you guys who are going to be identified with me, who are going to embody my values in this world. That is, our approach is going to be different. The disciples were wanting greatness. And by that, the idea of wanting greatness there was that they wanted the best life they could possibly have on this earth. They wanted to live the very best life that they could possibly experience. That's the underlying motivation there. So Jesus doesn't say there's anything wrong with wanting the best life that we could possibly have. There's nothing wrong with trying to live large in that regard. It's just that the way that they were trying to achieve it was the same twisted way that this world has been going about it. And it's a way that never works. It does not work. It will not last. It can't happen that way. It's just the way it is. So what he tells us is this, that our best life isn't found by trying to get ahead, but in sacrificial service for others. That's where the best life is actually found. The disciples were trying to find their best life by looking for validation from their peers. They wanted the people around them to say, "Yeah, you are pretty awesome, buddy. You are pretty cool." The most obvious way to do that sort of thing, to get that sort of validation, is to try to elevate yourself above everyone else. But Jesus points in the opposite direction. And so what he describes in reality is this sort of descent into greatness. This descent into serving others and finding wholeness there. You don't find our best life by trying to advance ourselves above everybody else, but rather by putting other people first and serving their needs. The greatest, he says, are going to be like the youngest. Now, the youngest, literally, he means like a child. The literal word in the Greek is speaking about a little child. It doesn't mean that we're going to behave childishly. They were already doing that. We kind of established that. It means that we're going to take the least position. The youngest, literally, in that culture and time, was without any sort of independent rights. They were the least in the family, familial hierarchy. They were the least. They were considered the least. They were basically a servant until they reached adulthood. And I know that, you know, there could be young people who are going, "I feel like a servant now. I don't want to take out the trash and blah, blah, blah." Believe me, it was a whole lot different back then. that whole realm is that they, before they reached adulthood, they weren't even adopted in. They were basically just servants there on the same rank as the servants and the slaves within a household. And so Jesus is telling us that those are the attributes that make us great. That willingness to become a servant and a slave. That willingness to serve each other in humility. Sacrificially laying down our own quest for our own rights and putting other people first before ourselves. Now the disciples were arguing there about who was going to be top dog. Who was more deserving of honor and respect sitting there. Who was the one who was least likely the one who was going to betray Jesus. But Jesus is telling them again that those are the values of the old way of understanding life, the old way of trying to find validation and humanity. That's not where it's found. Our best life is found in putting other people first. Now, this is radical because it goes so against the grain. I mean, that goes against the grain of everything we've ever known, doesn't it? I mean, we don't just give up the right to be the center of all the attention or to be number one. That's just not normal. What football team ever goes out on the field and gets in a circle and goes, "We're going to help the other team win"? I mean, you know, I mean, that would be like the Indianapolis Colts, I guess. I mean, which, if we're looking at it, that's the most godly team out there right now because they let everybody win going before them. Take that, Green Bay. But anyway, but the normal way. You know, the normal way that we're called to, where we look at the normal lines that we see, we believe are leading us towards advancing ourselves and elevating ourselves. But that's the way that's unfulfilling. It's the normal way, but it's the way that's not fulfilling, and it's not. And the more we try to pursue the best life by advancing our own ego, the more we're going to be frustrated by life. And the more we're going to have to try to gain and get in order to try to satisfy that ineffable longing and urge there. Jesus plainly tells us here, the path to living well is one where we lay down our rights to be appreciated, to be noticed, to be respected, lay down our rights to be served. But what he's really doing is he's inviting us to give up this claustrophobic, closed-in, selfish life for a larger-than life that is embracing others as well. That's enlarged because it's gathering so many lives into it. How can this possibly be the best path to life, we think? You know, how can serving others be really that beneficial? You know something? That we're actually hardwired for that. The studies that are coming out more frequently are revealing that that's a reality. We're hardwired to do that sort of thing. Studies have shown that there's a direct link between doing good and caring for others and our sense of wholeness or pleasure as human beings. There's physical parts of the brain that actually respond and release chemicals into our system when we're in the midst of doing altruistic things. We're created that way. We're built to do this sort of thing. That's how God made us. One university study which observed this link between doing good and feeling good said, you look at American society today, you look at the way, and this is not a religious thing at all, but it says you look at the way in which people are so caught up with a consumer ethic. You look at rows of self-help books in bookstores, people looking for some answer to why they don't feel good, why they're not happy. But when people are involved in a cause that they care about, when they can see how they can make a difference, it's a high, it's a rush. This makes people feel good, especially when they can see the results. Jesus is simply trying to teach us how to be human again. This is how we were made. This was what we were made for. He's trying to break us free from the programming that tricks us into climbing some ladder of success in order to feel fulfilled because that ladder is leading nowhere, is what he's trying to get across. The best life is found in serving others. And there's another reason that it's the best life. Look at what else Jesus says here in verse 27. For who is the greater, the one who reclines at the table or the one who serves? It's a rhetorical question. He's not expecting them to answer. Is it not the one who reclines at the table? But I am among you as the one who serves. If you go to a restaurant today after the meeting And you go and you sit down at a table, pay attention to the waiter or waitress who's taking care of your table and how you respond to them. What do you think of them? I mean, up until this moment before we started talking about it, do you ever sit there and think, oh, this is amazing. I can't believe I'm in the presence of someone like this who's actually coming and serving me. Like, this is greatness right here in my midst. We never usually think that, do we? I mean, you know, this is a person who's here to serve our needs. It's basically the extent of our thoughts about that individual. And the mind-blowing thing is, that's the place that Jesus came and took among us. He didn't descend from heaven in some fiery chariot. He didn't come to earth and get carted around on the shoulders of his followers. He came into the world, we're about to celebrate that in the next couple weeks. He came into the world as a baby. God became a baby. Let that ping around in your brain for a little while to try to get a grasp of that sort of thing. And then he lived as a waiter among us. That's how God came into the world to redeem it. It's incredible. I mean, it's unthinkable that this is what's described to us. There's nothing like this. All we've ever known is the idea that someone is recognized as successful by advancing himself above others. But here, Jesus himself modeled for us a new way, or really, actually, the original way, the right way to the best life. And so we know that it's the best life because it's like his life. And that's something else that we learn from this passage, that a life of putting others first is the best life because it's in harmony with God's character. This is what God is like. This is what his nature is. It's by this attitude that we most clearly reflect the one in whose image that we're made. And that's probably why it's so satisfying to us. That's probably why we get the rush that we get from it. Beyond just the centers of our brain lighting up and releasing chemicals, there is a satisfaction with coming back to original vocation. This is the kind of life that we were made for. We're designed to reflect God's image in this earth. That's why he made us in the beginning. And I think that there's never going to ever be anything more satisfying than living in harmony with that, than living in a way that reflects who he really is, what he's like, what his character's like. You know, it's a strange paradox, and we talked about this on last Wednesday night, but it's a strange paradox. Someone trying to be great, actually, that makes them less like God than anything else, because the one who is God left his place of majesty, and he took on the role of a waiter among us, living out this incredible mystery of this God who created all things, who displays this incredible humility. He is the most humble of all. This attitude of the hero king, it cuts right across the expectations of our culture. It's unthinkable. To find the best life, we have to live large in our willingness to serve other people, our willingness to put other people's needs first. And nowhere is that going to be more true than within this community of those who are modeling their lives after Christ, who are trying to follow in his pattern, the community of the church. You know, too often we approach a church, like I said before, like a consumer. We sort of walk in and we say, well, you know, we're here. How are you going to serve us? As opposed to coming in and saying, God, I want to be here to be of service. Help me to find my place to do that. And here in our weekly gatherings, we've got all kinds of opportunities to serve. And I know that there are many among us who do. And so that's a wonderful thing. But there's always a need for people to help with the kids, with greeters. I know that we need more in the technical aspects of media room and the sound room. We don't want to burn out the people that we do have serving there. But beyond that, beyond just these weekly meetings that require us to care for each other and to do things around here, beyond that, deeper than that, we're called to serve by helping one another through the difficulties and the challenges of life, those things that we face on a regular basis because of the nature of this world that we're living in. By praying for one another or visiting and comforting one another, assisting one another where we can. And that's only going to happen as we start to make deeper connections as a community, which is why, like we passed out those pamphlets today, why these small groups that are launching in January are really, really important. This is not just a program we're trying to do to fill up time. This is essential for us as a community to begin making those connections. It's important. I don't want anyone to just look at those things and those flyers and say, you know, I don't need that kind of stuff. I don't need to meet with people like that. But the question then remains, how do you serve then? If you don't need it, but how do you serve? How do you serve? And if we're not serving, how are we living in harmony with Jesus? And if we're not living in harmony with Jesus, how in the world are we experiencing the best life that there is? That larger than life that's incorporating more than just our own small self. It's important to the extreme that we connect with other travelers here so that we can grow into the life that we were meant to live, grow into that life that God intended for us. And from there, as we grow into that, we can reach out to other people. We can actually start making that difference in this world around us, meeting those needs of people in the world where we've been placed, expanding out beyond just the community that we experience these things. We can make a difference in this world through how we're representing who He is. That's the kind of life that Jesus lived. And that's the only kind of life that's ultimately going to satisfy us. Well, finishing up here this morning, verse 28, Jesus goes on to say this to His disciples. You are those who stayed with me in my trials, and I assign to you, as my Father assigned to me, a kingdom, that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Now here Jesus sort of wraps this whole thing up. And to paraphrase it, here's what He's basically saying to them. And I want you to think about what it is in light of where we started. Remember where we started. Well, we started with what? What was happening? What were the disciples wanting to know? Who's the coolest? Who's the greatest? Who's the best among us all? And here's how Jesus resolves this. This is where He brings this all up. And paraphrasing it, He's basically saying, you guys, you're trying to find greatness by one-upping each other. But you need to know that I think you're great already. You've stuck with me through thick and thin, even when your lives have been on the line. You've been there with me. You're great because you're invested in my kingdom, and I'm going to share my kingdom with you. And that's a kingdom that overshadows the old kingdom of its 12 tribes. That's how great you are to me. And suddenly this whole thing comes into perspective. The way that Jesus resolves this is amazing to me. We wonder how the best life can be a life that puts other people first. But we realize from what Jesus says here that we can put other people first because God puts us first. We can live that kind of life that serves others because God is actually looking at us. We don't have to run around and get validation from our fellow human beings because God is wanting to validate us, is desiring to give us that validation we crave. That's what makes this whole thing work. I mean, just think of the great love that's represented in this section. Instead of, you know, slapping his forehead when this whole thing starts and just pushing off from the table and say, that's it, I've had it with this. How many times are we going to go around this block? I don't need disciples this bad. I'll go do this on my own. Instead of doing that, He gently instructs them again, but not just instructs them, He reaffirms just how valuable they are to Him. Man, we can love others. We can serve others because God has loved us and God serves us like He does when He doesn't have to. We don't depend on the little affirmations that we get from our fellow broken human beings. We have the greatest affirmation that there is. The Creator loves us. And as we said last week, He likes us. He wants to be with us. He's interested in our lives and making sure that we're experiencing the best life that we can. What else could we need? I mean, what else could we need to find that sense of wholeness? What else could we need to get grounded in stability, in the knowledge of who we are, in light of who loves us? What else could we possibly need? It's His great love for us that not only secures us, but it motivates us then to love others, to serve others. That's the making of a full life, and that is cooperating with God's redeeming love. We're cooperating with what it is He's doing in our lives, in our hearts, and we're expressing that outwardly. We're expressing that on and outward. It's His great love for us that gives us that motivation, that desire to make a difference. I mean, the sheer enormity of God's grace that gets revealed in this section is just amazing to me. Here in the face of a group of guys who apparently just didn't get it I mean, it couldn't get any thicker than that. They just did not get what was going on right there. After all this time, after Jesus' own testimony about how he's going to sacrifice himself, they start fighting and bickering over their own petty sense of self-importance in the face of Jesus' great sacrifice. But that doesn't change God's love or his plans for them whatsoever. That ridiculous outburst on their part did not alter God's course for their life, what it is that he planned to do. You got to let that sink in for just a moment. God's redeeming work goes ahead despite of all of the human failure that seems to surround it. Jesus speaks these commending words to guys who are vying for a position of power just moments before. And I don't know, that is just somehow strangely comforting to me to see how he responds to them, to look at this. It settles my heart down. It calms my fears. It sets me free so that I want to serve, so that I want to be like that. I don't have to fight for my place at the table. It's been set and nothing seems to be moving that, even my own stupidity at times. So I can take the focus off of myself. I can let go of this self-absorbed wallowing in my failures. I can let go of that. And I can start looking forward, looking outward to the needs of others around me. I can start looking out to see how I can make a difference in the world, how I can express that same kind of amazing love and grace to people so desperately in need of it, as everybody in this world is. And you know, what we realize too, what we see even from what he's saying here, and even how, you know, not a bit of gratitude was showed by the disciples at that table. It's not at least recorded here for us. There's no point in which Jesus is explaining what it is that he's going to do. He gives them bread and cup, tangible explanations about what it is he's about to face. Not one person said, "This is amazing. Thank you so much, Jesus. I just can't believe this is all for me." Not a one. No, they were all just, "Oh, yeah. And by the way, I am pretty awesome, aren't I, in the midst of all of this?" And what we realize then, even as we look at Jesus' example, we're going to follow that up. We're going to follow his example and do that. We're going to be able to find our affirmation in God's love for us. And so that means we may serve and lay down our lives and put others first. And it may go unnoticed by the people around us here. I mean, that's just the reality of it that we've got to deal with. We may not hear any thank yous or get any pats on the back along the way saying, "Great job, you're awesome." But we don't want to let that discourage us at all. And Jesus tells us something here that lets us know why we should never be discouraged if we're not recognized in the midst of some service that we get. Because even though we may go all out for other people and never may hear a thank you right here and now from them, that doesn't mean that there will never be a thank you. That doesn't mean that it's never going to happen. In fact, there's a thank you coming that's better than any that we could ever receive from anybody around us here in this life. One day when this is over, when we're standing with him, we're going to hear the best thing that we could ever possibly hear, the absolute best thing to hear. We're going to be embraced and hear, "Well done. Good job. In essence, thank you, my good and faithful servant. Come on in. I got a seat saved for you here. I've been holding it for you. Come on in. I'm so glad you're here. I've been wanting to hang with you. I've loved serving with you. Come on in. There's a seat waiting for you here." That's the greatest thing I can think of. That's the only thank you that I need to hear. That's the one I always want to keep in mind. That's the one I want to hear. That's the one I want you to hear. With all of my heart, I want you to hear it. That's what makes this the best life of all. This is a larger than life because it has that kind of hope in eternity. That there's something else. As much as we don't understand it or can't describe it, there's something else beyond what we've experienced here. This selfish, closed-in life, man, it gets so claustrophobic when all it is us in our own little universe. It's a selfish life and it makes us stupid. It makes us do things that are ridiculous that we look back on and cringe when we have a little bit of clarity along the way. So let's live large. Let's see this example left to us by Jesus. Let's learn the lessons of what it is that he says here. Let's live large by living with other people in view, living the best life by serving each other, by living in harmony with God's character, which is one of humility and service, a desire to care for others and take care of needs. And we can do that. And we can do that without fear that we're somehow going to disappear in the mix, because God loves us. God knows us, and he cares about us, and he likes us, and he wants to serve with us, and he wants to do this together with us. That knowledge that provides us that great sense of security that no matter what anyone else in this world may think of me, I know that he likes me and I'm loved. That makes me able to be strong enough to shoulder other people's difficulties and problems beyond my own. That makes me in connection with God and makes my shoulders that much bigger as I go along. To know that we're loved by God, that's the motivating force that enables us, not out of religious obligation, but out of a sense of strength and stability and wholeness, to make a difference in this world by doing that good that endures. So let's take that challenge. Let's live that way. Right on?
Right on.
All right, cool. Why don't you guys stand with me, please? Somebody might want to go tell the kids' classrooms back there that Rob pulled another shocker and is done. But Father, we just thank you so much for this amazing love. How can we ever possibly express it enough? In spite of all the stupid things we do, and you know us, you remember our frame, you know that we're made of dust. In spite of all of that, your plans, your purposes go forward. Your redeeming love ever advances, and it continues to wrap us up and hold us steady and still. And so we thank you for that, God. So I pray for every person here this morning that we find our stability, that we're centered in the knowledge that you care about us, that you love us, and from there, that we can make a difference in this world. I pray that every person in this room this coming week makes a difference in this world by the love and the service that they show to one other person. I pray that you do that, Lord, so that we can recognize it and see your work in our midst. I pray, Father, that your kingdom advances step by step, act of love by act of love, so that this world eventually is reshaped into your original plan. You'll come and you'll do that, Lord, in your time, but God, help us to work in harmony with that now. I pray these things for us, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen.